Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk Bed Bath & Beyond. We'll also discuss Sprouts and their plans to expand into three new markets. We also get some of those sales figures we were promised from Macy's and Kohl's. We'll discuss that. And we've got an update on Sears Holdings. A reminder to rate us and follow us wherever you do access us. And find us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. We lead today's show with this, kind of a surprise, as a judge gives Eddie Lampert yet more time to save Sears Holdings. This afternoon's circulated early in the week about inevitable liquidation. If you checked any of the major media outlets Monday, Tuesday, it looked like liquidation was inevitable, that we were at the end of Sears and Kmart. But lo and behold, an extension granted, and Eddie Lampert has yet another chance to bring Sears back from the proverbial dead. On Monday, the company's board will be forced to consider yet another bid from former CEO Eddie Lampert for many of the remaining assets that the retailer has. And the company has closed over 125 Sears locations and over 200 Kmart locations over the past 3 years as they keep professing a route to profitability via cost cutting. That hasn't happened, and Eddie Lampert's obvious ineffectiveness as a manager has made many believe that any potential bid through Lampert's personal funds or his hedge fund ESL Investments would amount to basically little in the long term anyway, and that's one of the reasons why creditors very reluctant to accept anything from him.
For many, including us, it is still much of a surprise that Sears is still doing business 126 years later after they were first on the market. And you see that Sears should have probably been filing bankruptcy 1 to 2 years ago, but they were kept afloat by Eddie Lampert's loans through ESL Investments over the past couple of years. They've been hemorrhaging millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. They've been able to really stay afloat via spinoffs of brands and the creation of Seritage Growth Properties, which is a REIT, and that helped liquidity in the short term. But the main question of how to get more customers to shop at Sears and Kmart and the older retailer has not been reasonably addressed by Lampert in the first place, who also faced a high turnover rate in the executive suite. Lampert, by the way, manages things remotely, so he's not around all of the senior managers that you really should have a positive influence over in these hard times. But that is not the case. And so Lampert, who, by the way, is still chairman and a leading shareholder of both ESL and Sears, agreed last week to assume more than $600 million in additional liabilities that Sears has incurred since filing for bankruptcy protection this last October. And you think back, yes, October. Feels like we've been talking about Sears quite a bit, but the truth of the matter is a lot of things are going on behind the scenes, and we'll talk about the expense of that here in a little bit. But Lampert's initial bid of around $3 billion would have essentially dismissed a lot of outstanding debt obligations, which for creditors thought it would just be better to liquidate entirely because they maybe then would be paid a little bit more. So it isn't clear to us what an all-out liquidation would look like in terms of how much the proceeds would actually bring to the table and to be spread out through a multitude of parties. But you have to look at the big picture here. So Eddie Lampert actually put in an initial bid, which is around $4.4 billion. But it did some funny things. And one of the things it did is it would bring $1.3 billion in debt currently and exchange that for equity. And a lot of people were saying that Eddie Lampert is basically saying that he is, in other words, not trying to be a part of this winning bid process. And a lot of people are saying that he underbid the initial bid, but it looks as though now he's sort of changed course and he's making it a little bit more attractive for the court, for everyone involved, all of the stakeholders to approve this additional bid, which has to be done by Monday, or at least so that we've heard. Lampert and Sears are rumored to face several lawsuits depending on how things play out as well. Some analysts seem unsure that the lawsuits will be created regarding some of the real estate assets that Lampert now holds through his REIT, Seritage Growth Properties. In addition, Sears has a legacy pension fund that is outstanding that would, in theory, also be owed some of the funds from a larger or entire liquidation of Sears Holdings. And so We see that there is an excellent article from a few months ago via the Chicago Tribune that points out there are still 90,000 people, by the way, that are in the Sears pension program and that it could be at risk if Sears go under. However, despite using the sale of certain assets to continue to fund the pension has still been about $1 billion underfunded for the past several years now. You think about 90,000 people needing those paychecks to come on a routine basis. The Sears bankruptcy is certainly going to affect those people. However, there is a federal precedent to ensure these types of things actually do get funded for the long term. The Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation has footed the bill for nearly 5,000 failed employer pension plans since its founding in 1974. You know what? They would be on the hook for that amount. So this is yet another stakeholder that would have a say, or at least want to have a say, in the proceedings going forward. However, logically speaking, this is not something that the federal government would really be able to do, or at least outwardly do. But historically, they would probably want the company to stay around a little bit longer to mitigate what they're on the hook for. So if Sears does go under, let's say in 6 months or a year or 2 years, that would, in theory, be better than right now, where they're $1 billion underfunded. CEO Eddie Lampert actually wrote in September that Sears has contributed more than $4.5 billion to its pension plans since 2005, an obligation that he says significantly impacted, and I quote, significantly impacted the company, which has turned an annual profit or hasn't turned an annual profit since 2010. And Trent, I believe that is yet another way that Eddie Lampert tries to divert attention from his mismanagement in the company by basically blaming things that he already knew were a part of Sears when he took over.
It just like last year, for example, when Lampert was blaming a soft retail environment rather than truly trying to transform the retailer with action rather than rhetoric. And Reuters actually points out that legal costs and preparation fees associated with real estate could be in the tens of millions. More money, of course, that Sears does not have. They've enlisted six law firms in total. One of them made news by declaring that their bill to Sears was already $5 million for 2 weeks worth of work. Now, according to court filings, there are 36 lawyers that are working for at least $1,000 an hour to lay out the facts properly. Toys R Us, meanwhile, as a comparison, reportedly had $375 million in attorney's fees for 72 different firms. Now, we mentioned all of these circulating facts basically to note that an extension beyond this week as far as a final decision in the company's future is unlikely, although we've seen several extensions to this point, so not ruling anything out. But each second that goes on without a formal ruling is costly for all stakeholders, except, of course, the lawyers, because even if you do liquidate, or if you're forced to liquidate in your Sears, well, now a lot of that liquidation money's got to go to the lawyers as well. So those creditors aren't going to get as much money if things continue to get extended out. Now, we've seen several extensions to this point where originally it thought that things were just dead in the water, but basically Sears Holdings in terms of the stock is now SHLDQ, Q now at the end to denote ongoing bankruptcy proceedings. They're hovering around that 41 cent mark, giving the remaining outstanding shares a value of $44.9 million, so certainly not a whole lot in terms of that market cap there, but it will be interesting to see, do we get another extension? Do things actually fall as expected on Monday? Will Sears and Kmart be forced to liquidate? Does someone step up and maybe save one of the brands long term? A lot to be found out here, but one thing is for sure that, again, the only party that wins in all this, as always, Leighton, it's the lawyers. So we talk two department stores now as Macy's and Kohl's. Both released holiday sales numbers, and they weren't as sterling as originally forecast. We talked last week about how this is usually the week we start to get some of those holiday sales numbers pouring in. Usually not quarterly results just yet, but holiday sales updates so that there aren't any huge surprises when those quarterly numbers do come out. And as we begin this story, we should keep in mind that early data from payment systems, so systems that process payment or payment processors, still indicate a robust shopping season overall. However, it didn't seem to translate as powerfully to either of these department stores. Now, this is, as we mentioned, the week we start to get some of this data. So a soft first week, but as we head into next week, we shall see if some retailers showed more sterling data than others. After all, we know, again, payment processors said spending was up basically across the board. First, let's talk about Macy's. Now, Macy's stock fell over 18% at certain points last Thursday as the company lowered full-year guidance, which means that their latest quarter, which includes the holiday sales, may not have been as stellar as anticipated. Macy's had a lot of momentum going into the holiday season, and they've been kind of the one legacy department store that's performed well in-store and online as management has reinvested aggressively in discounted assortment and also their omni-channel functions. Now, the full-year earnings per share range is now between $3.95 to $4 as a forecast, down from $4.10 to $4.30. Holiday sales comps hit just an increase of 0.7%, far below where some expected, especially in this retail climate when we're talking about comps over last year running anywhere between 4% and 5.5% for the overall retail landscape. And we expected 3 to 4%, kind of in line with previous months and quarters, but definitely did not come in where the company expected, where a lot of analysts expected. As a result, you saw that stock drop. Management expecting their full-year comp store sales growth of approximately 2%. Still good for Macy's, but down from the 2.3 to 2.5% range it previously gave. And of course, that's because of the hit they took during this holiday season. Oddly enough, though, licensed stores did do noticeably better, Leighton, than the company-owned stores.
Yeah, they did. I believe they came in, or at least brought the average up to around 1.2, 1.3%. So if you include owned stores and licensed stores, it was above that 0.7 mark that Trent just talked about with their own owned brick and mortar stores. But if you look at some quotes, you see that Macy's CEO Jeff Gennett said that the holiday season began strong, particularly during Black Friday and the following Cyber Week, but weakened in the mid-December period and did not return to expected patterns until the week of Christmas. And he actually went on to say, along with some other remarks, that the last half of December was actually fairly strong. But you really have to scratch your head and match that up with what you and I have both seen anecdotally by driving around and visiting stores during the last 2.5 months. You're seeing that there was sort of a drop off after Black Friday. A lot of people, either they were shopping online or they were just burnt out all of those shopping promotions that were going on in a number of retailers that we've been all over on this particular podcast. You talk about the mid segment of December, or the first week to maybe the third week in December. A lot of people, I don't believe it was about procrastination this year. I believe a lot of it had to do with most people got their shopping out of the way and they just were tired of the crowds and they were tired of being inundated with all of the promotions. Because if there's one thing to draw from the last couple of months, it's the fact that retailers did not take a day off in terms of social media and other marketing campaigns that were going on. They went full throttle in terms of everything that they were doing, trying to relate the particular messages to the consumer regarding specific items. And that's something we talked about here recently with Target and Walmart, and the fact that they weren't just advertising blanket sales on toys or the fact that they have more product assortment. They were talking about specifically what items they were carrying that other retailers were not. And I believe that had a huge part in Black Friday sales, but you know, maybe we will see sort of a drop off with other retailers outside of Macy's as well. The general positives were that Macy's Backstage concept, their discount store within a store model, did well and continued to leverage floor space. And this is something that we talked about in terms of Macy's having a massive amount of square footage to have to deal with. A lot of people, a lot of investment groups telling Macy's, you know what, maybe it's time to liquidate. Maybe it's time to divest some of those more expensive properties to extract short-term or mid-term value. But they've actually been benefiting from investing in their current stores, having that discount store. And I think it's really helped in terms of traffic, because not only are customers going to buy what's in the Backstage concept, they're also going to buy those items that are to and from the Backstage concept in their store, especially how they locate the Backstage concept in a number of their stores. It's sort of in a corner. You have to go through a lot of other areas in order to get to that particular point. But store pickup was also used a little bit more, they note, and loyalty rewards also has traction. Between these initiatives and the other general trends that we've been talking about, traffic did pick up during the last week of December, according to management. So again, the fourth week in December was generally positive for Macy's. Jewelry and women's shoes performed well, which is always a good area for them. Couple soft spots, but we won't necessarily touch on those. We want to wait until they come out with the official earnings release. Management said that at the end of their comments that they viewed the holiday season, or at least the last few months, as an overall positive, despite the weakness here that we note in December, and that store personnel are looking to ride sales momentum into 2019, a year that may prove difficult for those that had a little bit of softness later in the year, but they're still looking to beat many of their 2018 achievements.
Now let's move on to Kohl's. Kohl's is the lower priced, almost anti-indoor mall department store alternative because so many of the stores are freestanding. Did fare better than Macy's. Now, shares of Kohl's, ticker KSS, did fall almost 5% on Thursday to $66.54 per share, still above by a far cry where they were a year or even 2 years ago. Kohl's had an impressive run stock-wise during the second half of 2018, with shares reaching all-time highs near $82 in November. But with a glimpse into holiday sales numbers, we can see now that November same-store sales were only up 1.2%. During the same time last year, same-store sales were up over 6% over 2016. Now, CEO Michelle Goss said that it was still a very strong holiday, and I quote, very strong holiday from her, on top of last year's exceptional holiday season, or what she called an exceptional holiday season last year. She added the retailer saw double-digit sales growth online this past November and December. Granted, those are numbers that we're seeing from pretty much every retailer, so doesn't exempt Kohl's from some of the negative news coming out. If you're only comping 1.2% across the board, again, in a retail sales environment where we know sales were up around 4 to 5.5%, it doesn't compare favorably with some of your competitors. Now, the double-digit e-commerce sales, as we mentioned, they're to be expected, but we're kind of wondering specifically what level they rose. You can talk about double-digit sales growth, but 11% is a lot different than 30%. For Kohl's, anything over 20% would be on par with a company that is performing fairly well and starting to ramp up their omni-channel approach. Now, sales stemming from mobile, they did say, were up, and anecdotally, people enjoyed the improvements on their platforms, but the key is for Kohl's across the board, they had to improve as a company a little bit more than that 1.2%, and we just did not see it. They were also unclear as far as which departments did the best, but analysts said that Kohl's no doubt benefited from Sears and Toys R Us closures. We've talked about them ramping up some of their toy selections in stores as well. Leighton talked, in fact, about a toy four-way being in the middle of men's suits. So in theory, all apparel and jewelry categories as well as toys saw revenue improvement if analysts are correct and you saw that benefit from Sears closures as well as Toys R Us closures. One thing we did notice was that electronics and toys, again, took up a ton of sales floor space, but electronics, not really something that a lot of people talked about late, and a lot of people discussed the toys, but not many people talked electronics, and that was something that we noticed was given a lot more floor space in the time prior to December.
Especially in areas near the West Coast where I now live, you see the Amazon partnership really coming to fruition. A lot of people excited about that. A lot of signage now denoting the Amazon partnership on the outside of the building, obviously to draw a little bit of traffic, but also a little bit of newsworthiness, because anytime you relate the Amazon name to anything nowadays, it becomes big. And speaking of big, big picture, we do have to keep in mind that Kohl's has been doing significantly better since the holiday shopping season last year, where they hit a record for digital sales. And a lot of people forget that. They hit an in-house record that was huge last year for digital sales at the end of 2017. Yet they're breaking those records now, but it doesn't seem as big of a deal. So I think you really have to take the softness now with a little bit of a grain of salt, even though pretty much every time we talk about these stories, it's always about what have you done for me lately. We still have to look at the fact that Kohl's is still largely on the right track and they've employed the right strategy to maximize value in their stores and to make everything a little bit more efficient throughout their supply chain so that they are truly adhering to their mission of being a fully operational omni-channel retailer. Go to Bed Bath & Beyond as they released earnings this Wednesday that had been previously delayed for the past 52 weeks. Just prior to the long-awaited third quarter release here, shares were down 52%, actually a little bit over 52% if you do the math, but their second quarter release saw the company lose about half of their total market value. So think about this, a lot of that downside has to do with their second quarter, the quarter before this latest reportable period, which, by the way, now sees the stock price sit around $2 billion. So it brought the market cap down significantly for Bed Bath & Beyond. And Bed Bath & Beyond, one of those retailers that has been around for a while, but a retailer that we've been critical of, and we know that a lot of other analysts that have podcasts have been talking about this retailer not really evolving. The company has seen shrinking margins consistently as they've largely failed to evolve in their staple stores. By the way, they have World Market and Bye Bye Baby, which have been actually fairly stable. We think they could actually still do better, considering the latter is attempting to take market share away from the Babies R Us exit, but a lot of other people, a lot of other retailers have their hands in that particular pie. The company's earnings release and forward guidance boosted the stock nearly 20% prior to market open on Thursday. And I think a lot of this is a result of how far the stock has been down. So the stock's been down significantly. So I think investors were just waiting for something positive to emerge. And there was a lot of positivity in terms of forward guidance. We're talking about a year and a quarter away from now. The company predicts some stability. So we have to wait and see how the next few quarters play out. But this latest quarter's earnings report was more about the relative margin improvement over actually drawing any significant amount of customers to their stores or online channels, something they continue to struggle with despite varying strategies that they've employed over the past 3.5 years. Adjusted earnings per share hit 18 cents while analysts were projecting just 17 cents per share. So 1 cent, not that bad, a pretty good beat. Something, again, a lot of analysts have been looking towards because the assumption is that their top line revenue is going to continue to stagnate or even decrease as the quarters go by. Top line revenue, speaking of that, came in at $3.03 billion. Just about $10 million off of Wall Street expectations there. As part of that top line revenue, Trent, same store sales fell by a little bit more than some had anticipated. Same store sales fell by 1.8% in the quarter. Average analyst estimates predicted 0.3%. So a big hit there. And I think that slight margin improvement, that is just not enough to reinstill faith in the company's strategy going forward.
And honestly, you know, had we known same store sales were going to fall this drastically in this particular quarter, we talked a couple of episodes ago about our five most struggling retailers for calendar year 2018. Honestly, Bed Bath & Beyond probably deserves a spot on that list ahead of a couple of retailers we listed simply because they just made no improvements during their last quarter, except on that bottom line where, again, they beat on adjusted earnings per share. They're still profitable, but as you mentioned, Leighton, that number may shrink or continue to shrink if they can't find a way to bring top line up. Now, management gave a bunch of updates via a slideshow presentation for a number of initiatives. The initiative that probably got the most press was their next generation stores, which is something that we've talked about them trialing in the past, but they also discussed at length what they call FEO or front end optimization. Honestly, the front end, at least in their flagship stores, their Bed Bath & Beyond stores, could use a little bit of work. There's not a whole lot of impulse buys there towards the front end, doing a little bit of a sloppy job with the front end in those particular stores. Not necessarily so much with World Market and Bye Bye Baby there, but also decorative furnishings. That's something they feel like they devote more square footage to that will improve their stores long term. And remember, we should go back to a couple of quarters ago where management actually talked about being able to bring down lease rates on some of their stores, and they thought they could favorably negotiate lease rates. Well, we've talked time and again about how retail vacancies just aren't popping up where a lot of people thought they might be, and landlords aren't super excited about negotiating lease rates down because there are a lot of retailers that fill Bed Bath & Beyond type spaces that are growing as of right now. So that's something that maybe management didn't experience that much of a difference in over a couple of quarters ago is the renegotiation of leases. And that's something that they're not likely to see a large benefit from, at least for the next 1 to 2 years. So they need these type of initiatives, whether it's front-end optimization or rolling out these next-generation stores to try to improve operationally. Now, within all of these larger projects, they have emphasized execution at the store level. So often we see corporate initiatives not be executed at the store level. That's what they're focusing on here. So marketing, service quality, assortment, operational excellence, all key factors that they're watching on the ground level to make sure some of these initiatives are followed through upon store-by-store basis. Now, front-end optimization has a lot to do with their e-commerce, despite what the name would suggest, because they want their digital footprint to be cleaner and improve things like load times, but also they want that seamless in-store online experience, and that's something that up until their next generation stores, they didn't really have and still don't have. There's a little bit of a sloppy exchange there between some of their online aspects, particularly their registry, and some of their offline or in-store aspects. Now, as far as what the second initiative, that next generation store, has to do with in-store progress, this goes back to their merchandising roots. Bed Bath & Beyond, when they kind of rose to prominence in the 90s and early aughts, they were thought to be kind of the kings of merchandising there. They need to kind of shift their focus, because merchandising now, much different than merchandising in 2002. They want more lab locations to try out different merchandising techniques in certain markets. They have currently 18 lab stores started, and once they tinker with the approach a little bit, they'll have a greater idea of what that next generation store will look like across the chain. Given the pictures we were able to obtain, the display methodology works to bring to life real-world designing, kind of a showroom concept, but not necessarily full restoration hardware in that example. For instance, they're looking to dedicate more room to have products spread out. IKEA would be another, maybe a better comparison there, so that people can visualize and see and touch and interact with those designs that Bed Bath & Beyond is espousing with some of their products. Now, as far as leveraging any of their data, they weren't really clear as to what exactly they'd be looking at to decipher what's working and what's not. Obviously, you can look at sales figures from the displayed merchandise. That would be one metric, but anytime you set aside a special display for merchandise, chances are those sales are going to go up. I don't care if it's deli mustard that you're trying to sell in a Bed Bath & Beyond. If you have a special display for it, probably going to move more of that product. The key here is moving more product across the board, and that's why we're curious to see how executives are able to best make the right merchandising decisions, especially, Leighton, when you consider all of the different store sizes and different markets that they serve. I've been in some Bed Bath & Beyonds that run over 25,000 square feet. I was actually in one recently in Washington that ran only about 10 to 12,000 square feet. So a lot of different types of locations here, a lot of different things that they've got to figure out with these lab stores, and ultimately they want to have more of them.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a good idea to experiment with these 40 different lab locations across the nation. However, one thing to consider, one thing that you and I had talked about before recording this very podcast, was you are in so many different diverse markets. You have so many different footprints with varying square footages, as you just talked about, Trent, but you might then want to shy away from a one-size-fits-all approach. So all of these different lab locations, it's unclear as to their strategy going forward, but maybe one quote-unquote lab store per larger market to determine how each of those larger metropolitan areas reacts to the different pilot initiatives, and to maybe employ those best use strategies to the adjacent location. So act accordingly depending on where you are serving. And I think that's going to be the best strategy for them, but it's unclear as to whether these larger implementations are actually going to spread out to all of their locations. So I believe that you need to, yes, one, have more lab stores throughout the United States, but two, look intimately into those markets that you serve, because a store in the Midwest, they might not want the same product selection as a store out West. Now, I believe that that is a very simple way of looking at these things, but I do believe that if you employ the one-size-fits-all strategy, it's not going to work for you long-term. And to say that it is a simple approach to look at the markets intimately that you serve is sort of practical and logical, it is saying that because Bed Bath & Beyond hasn't been doing very logical things over the past few years to try to evolve as a retailer. They have been taking the one-size-fits-all approach. And guess what? It has lost them significant amounts of market share. And speaking of moving forward, we look to their last major endeavor here, Trent, which is decorative furnishings. They're looking to be working more intimately with suppliers and vendors of certain brands, and also have their own private label brands that they're going to want to be showcasing. In terms of product type. You look at the different types of products they have now, they actually want to expand those. And this is something we touched on a couple quarters ago. Historically, wall decor and rugs have been staples in this particular niche. They want to extend out into anything that could even be considered a decorative furnishing. So think of everything that could be sort of manipulated to be in this particular category that fits in a room, a bedroom, a living room. Think of things like lighting or any type of commodity. Instead of looking at it as a commodity, you think of it as an accessory, something that could be added on, give a little bit more of a touch, a finishing touch for whatever room you're trying to redesign. They want to bring out in-house designs like lighting, like I just said, and also seasonal accessories. So they want to bring it all in-house and have that as part of their previous initiative. So both with online marketing and their in-store merchandising. So this, in our view, is an intelligent path for Bed Bath & Beyond, but also one that is taking place out of necessity. Because if you think about their competition, all of those online entrants that are coming up with all of the different products, that massive product assortment that you can have when you have a ton of different suppliers online, they're now competing against the Wayfairs of the world that have pretty much every accessory, everything that could fall under decorative furnishing. These retailers have it. So it's really just sort of a natural extension for Bed Bath & Beyond if they want to sustain in any sort of way in that particular category. Think about this. Even if inventory turn is slower on these new lighting items, for instance, holding your designs and your private label brands should help to sustain margins because these are more higher margin things and you're bringing more traffic to the stores. And like we had noted previously on another podcast, it's always best to have as much product assortment as you can, as long as you don't drown down inventory. And I think it's a really good thing for the most loyal customers because guess what? The most loyal customers are actually going to appreciate the product extension. So as we noted already, all of these will take a good amount of resources and departmental focus to execute at a high level, in particular, all of the networking things they're doing for site improvement. In their prepared remarks, the company was clear to note that they will have to hire and nourish talent and data analytics and engineering teams, and I believe that is a very important facet for these retailers during their evolution. Also, a focus on the basics that arguably brought them to prominence in the beginning. Clean stores, less clutter, and an efficient corporate culture that we have not seen during the last couple of years.
Particularly the less clutter aspect of it, because honestly, some of their stores, especially if you get towards the clearance areas or towards the sale items, tend to be a little bit more cluttered now. And Bed Bath & Beyond, during the call, did note that leaner and more efficient as a larger retailer, what that means is they expect to operate less stores going forward. Now, few details are available there, but we're going to keep an eye on what markets will be extinguished. Now, Leighton, I know since moving to Southern California, you've noted Bed Bath & Beyond is actually immensely popular in that area, and that we've noted that despite lower traffic levels, the company's actually grown out in the Midwest over the past half decade. In our travels, both of us have seen new Bed Bath & Beyond stores, new Bye Bye Baby stores, and New World Market stores, all throughout the Midwest. So it'd be interesting to see whether they kind of walk that strategy back or they keep those stores in the Midwest. If they're the ones that are performing well, maybe shrink back in some of the East Coast or Southern markets. Now, one of the things that we should note is fiscal 2018, of course, has proven to be a tough year when comparing sales and operating margins to 2017, when the retailer was doing just all right. Forward guidance sees fiscal 2019 earnings per share being about the same as 2018. So beating Wall Street consensus, which projected a 21% decline. Now, granted, we'll kind of wait and see where they do fall in on fiscal 2019. Shares still ended Friday down at $15.23 or $15.23. 5-year highs, let's remember, over $75. Lows recently near 10. Since 2015, the company has pretty much been in a free fall, though. It's maintaining the same market presence, no longer a winning strategy. There was a point, actually, right around towards 2015 into 2016 that Bed Bath & Beyond was thought to be the retailer that was perhaps going to buck some of the brick and mortar trends. Well, we've seen brick and mortar kind of bounce back in the last couple of years. Bed Bath & Beyond hasn't been part of that. So we move on with our final news story here on the Retail Focus podcast. Just after discussing Amazon's efforts to expand Whole Foods' reach last week, Sprouts announced Tuesday their intention to enter three new markets this year. Now, this is something that was pre-planned, certainly before Amin Maredia, their CEO, announced that he was leaving the company. How Sprouts expands, and the reason we're covering it here, is they go market by market. They don't sprinkle stores throughout the country. They try to open up 2, 3, 4 stores in a given market when they do enter the market. So that's why this is big news. It's not just a smattering of stores throughout the country. And Sprouts has made impressive inroads in markets that are hyper-competitive, even markets that they're just recently getting to, and they've been able to squeeze out net margins that are comparable to others in the industry, if not better. Now, they had 170 stores for comparison in the first quarter of 2014, over 320 stores at the end of their latest reportable quarter, which ended on September 30th. So we're talking massive expansion, nearly 100% expansion during that time. And let's remember last year when they discussed their celebratory 300th store opening, that 320 number represents a presence in 19 states. So that spans the entire continental U.S., but again, very selective about the markets they jump into. And when they move into a market, they tend to expand rapidly within that particular market. So that number, that 320 number in terms of the store count, also means that their business has grown in terms of supporting a number of up-and-coming suppliers that normally just source to a select few grocers like Whole Foods or natural grocers, particularly natural grocers in the Southwest, market that's very familiar to Sprouts because they're based in Phoenix, Arizona. Now the company has around 29,000 employees still headquartered in Phoenix, but the latest news, Leighton, does indeed follow a trend that we've seen with physical grocers kind of doubling down on a physical presence, either through adding more stores or, like in Kroger's case, divesting parts of his business to enhance their traditional stores and their omnichannel spend.
Grocery and brick and mortar is here to stay, and I firsthand know that because of the Costco I just visited. It was inundated with what seemed to be tens of thousands of customers. That store, by the way, did over $300 million in revenue, a large percentage of that via groceries. So groceries are here to stay, and for Sprouts, geographically speaking, they are looking to hit the competition head on. They're looking directly at the east and southeastern parts of the United States in their latest bid to contend with longstanding chains. New states will include New Jersey, Louisiana, and Virginia. Each of those states will get one new location. They are looking to expand as aggressively in terms of an absolute store count in 2018. So in 2018, they had an additional 30 stores added to their store portfolio. We expect to see around 30 new total locations this year. In the second quarter alone, we got news that they will be adding 9 new stores. So 9 of the 30 will take place in the second quarter. This is when they enter those brand new states, by the way, so it's pretty important to note that all of the new stores are supposed to feature new digital and merchandising improvements based on the knowledge they have accrued from the existing store network. So I used to live in the Midwest where they opened a brand new Sprouts, and you can tell just within the first few months, they were already tweaking things from the rest of their store network, what the associates called best practices for merchandising. So marquee signage and new display cases for these locations are going to be at the butcher shop and the fish market to denote high quality fresh food akin to Whole Foods. And this is where they differentiate a little bit, because Whole Foods does a great job at letting their customers know what is where in each store. Each store has a different layout, but they try to make it easy for you to find. But also, again, they don't have a butcher shop in many of their locations, so they just have a normal section like you would see in a smaller regional grocery chain. During 2018, Sprouts entered 3 new states, so they're sort of keeping along with that trend as well. Pennsylvania, Washington, and South Carolina were the 3 new territories in 2008 for Sprouts. Washington being known for a massive Trader Joe's presence, but so far, anecdotally, the results seem to be okay for them. An example of Sprouts' competitive streak would also be their foray into the LA markets, where oftentimes Whole Foods and Ralph's are just across the street, or at least in the same complex. And a lot of times, maybe it's down the block, but still, it tells you that Sprouts is not afraid of competition. They're not afraid of meeting that opportunity. And I think for them, this is a really big positive, because if you listen to management's comments, they say that their new stores are performing better than expected. So I think it's really giving them the confidence to move forward. For this week, Trent, Wednesday the 16th, Sprouts is opening 4 new stores in Carlsbad and Fontana, California, Clearwater, Florida, and Carlsbad, Texas. I think these openings not only represent their progress in terms of concentrated areas, getting into densely populated metropolitan areas, but we need to mention their unique way of driving initial interest to these new stores.
Now, the company's promotional strategy for each new store includes a ribbon-cutting ceremony at 7 a.m. local time, having the first 200 shoppers receive 20% off of their initial purchase. Also, muffin and coffee samples will be served out. Every customer will receive a free reusable shopping bag with purchase, very much on brand, all of that for Sprouts. And we'll go ahead and assume every shopping bag also will be Sprouts branded. Additionally, each of these new stores will hold a Taste of Sprouts event on January 19th. Now, one may ask how a smaller but stretched out grocer is able to expand in a sustainable fashion so well, especially when they're sourcing so many of their products from local suppliers. Well, for one, Sprouts has done a great job in laying out needed cap expenditures for growth. They have a better feel for how much new store openings will cost. And something we've talked about in the past is that as they open stores, as they continue to open stores, store openings are getting much, much cheaper for Sprouts. They also have enough funds to continue a moderate expansion going forward, coming in with $145.8 million in net income for the 9 months so far in fiscal 2018. And lastly, they've noted that new stores are oftentimes performing either on par or better than they expected across the board. So that's going to give anyone in this type of space a bit more confidence when deciding whether or not to open a new location. When your new locations are performing so well, doesn't take that much to push you over the edge in terms of deciding to invest a market. Maybe, you know, if you have a location management is on the fence about, knowing that it's going to perform well, or knowing that historically new Sprouts markets have performed on par with their existing locations, certainly would be a major motivating factor. Now, rising interest rates will put added pressure on management to make these important decisions sooner than later. The sooner you can open those stores, the sooner you mitigate potentially rising interest rates, particularly in 2019, and interest rates that are predicted to continue rising going forward, at least if we don't see a little bit of a market downturn or some sort of correction longer term than what we saw in the fourth quarter of 2018. A lot of larger retailers, in fact, are planning to smooth out costs over the next decade because of uncertainty on this front. Now, shares of Sprouts, ticker SFM, standing for Sprouts Farmers Market, of course, have traded within a tight band over the last 52 weeks, not nearly up and down as some of the retailers that we've discussed on this podcast. Shares ended Friday at $24.04, which represents an over $3 billion market cap and a moderate price-to-earnings ratio of 23 times. Certainly suggestive that the market sees a little bit of growth potential, but not the type of growth potential that you see out of a Five Below or an Ollie's Bargain Outlet. Kroger, by the way, has a price-to-earnings ratio of 7 times with a $22.6 billion market cap and has that 2% dividend, whereas Sprouts doesn't, because, of course, they are funneling a lot of that money into growth currently.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a glance at a story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. We start with Leighton.
While we don't get political on the show, I would like to talk about the shutdown just briefly as it affects retail in a number of different ways. But the government shutdown is actually slowing FDA inspections. So food safety inspectors are actually working either less hours or have been furloughed entirely. Some 41% of the FDA employees have been furloughed. Not all of the FDA employees are obviously hired to analyze food production and produce in retail or in the logistics network where it inevitably does go to retail. But around 41%, like I said, of 17,000 employees are on furlough. They do about 160 inspections per week. So different food inspections here domestically in the United States. And what's interesting is they have had to cut back on these number of inspections. And so as it relates to retail, as it relates to a lot of the grocers we just talked about in this podcast, I'm curious to see if they hire anybody in-house to test the products that they're buying. Because obviously, if there's less inspections happening in real time, day to day, it really does increase the opportunity to have some sort of illness and to have something pass through that shouldn't have been that's high risk. And so I think a lot of this inventory, including seafood, cheese, infant formula, a lot of that is going to have to be looked through by companies that at least have the money to do that. So we're talking about the big players in this space, Costco, Walmart, Target. I think it would behoove them to catch something a little bit before it happens or before it hits their shelves. So that is my looking ahead for this week. Hopefully the government shutdown doesn't last too much longer so as to not worry the individual consumer.
Well, for the third time in 4 weeks, we are bringing up regional retailer Shopko, and that's because a pharmaceutical drug supplier has said that Shopko likely to file for bankruptcy as soon as this coming week. McKesson Corporation said it supplied Shopko with around $67 million in drugs since the beginning of November, but they haven't been paid since early December. That Shopko is actually behind on its payments. Now, to this point, Sun Capital Partners hasn't said anything about Shopko's current status. We know they went through, closed a handful of locations, or announced the closing of a handful of locations. And Leighton, this is what strikes me as odd about it, is they announced the closing of these locations, but you know, the timing of it is a little bit strange, because particularly if they're closing some of these locations prior to filing for bankruptcy, that would indicate that maybe, and we know some of the locations, the leases weren't up yet, but maybe with these Shopko locations that are closing, they knew all along that they were going to file for bankruptcy and therefore going to be able to get out of the leases a little bit easier once they did so. So wouldn't surprise us. And this is something that we said a couple of weeks ago when we named Shopko as one of our least functioning retailers of 2018, is that we know the liquidity isn't there. Bare store shelves seem to suggest that they don't have the money to pay suppliers. A lot of suppliers are starting to balk now at supplying Shopko. And McKesson, actually, as we mentioned, they're a pharmaceutical drug supplier. And of all the things that you would think Shopko would be functioning well in, it would be the pharmacy area, especially with the smaller hometown stores where oftentimes they're one of the only pharmacies in the market, if not the only pharmacy in the market. So if you can't run that, what can you run as a retail store? So again, not a surprise, but we're anxious to see more than anything here some of the financials, because Shopko, of course, privately owned by Sun Capital Partners, we don't get to see a lot in terms of publicly made available financials. What we have heard largely from inside sources indicates not good things going forward for Shopko. Wouldn't be surprised at all to see this bankruptcy come out next week or the week after that. But I just want to see how bad, truly, this situation has gotten for Shopko. And it's ironic because Shopko took over a lot of the bankrupt Alco locations that were in the middle part of the U.S. After Alco declared bankruptcy, Shopko swooped in, took over a lot of the locations, and now likely to see retailer number two go bankrupt in some of those same locations. We'll see if it means liquidation or if Shopko can work something out to remain a long-term functioning retailer. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Again, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. We'll be back at you 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.